Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Folklore, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm joined by Professor Li Junzhang and Ziying You to talk about their recently published edited volume, Chinese Folklore Studies Today, Discourse and Practice, published in 2019 with the Indiana University Press. Professor Zhang is an assistant professor in folklore studies at George Mason University, and Professor You is visiting assistant professor of Chinese and East Asian studies at the College of Worcester. Ziying and Li Jun, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me too.
So to start off, what I'd like to do is I'd like to just ask you sort of the standard first question. Can you tell us a little bit about yourselves? And we'll start with Ziying. What is your folklore origin story?
It was a long story. I was brought up by my grandparents in the countryside in Henan province, which is located in the central part of China. Since my early years, I was exposed to traditional ways of life in the rural village. My grandparents worked in their farmland. They also planted all kinds of vegetables in their gardens. We celebrated traditional festivals together, and my grandma often told me all kinds of stories. So folklore was everywhere around me, but I didn't know that it was an important field until I took a course in folk literature, during my junior year at Henan Normal University. Later, I wanted to study folk literature in the Chinese department at Beijing University. I earned my MA degree there. My advisor was Chen Yongchao, who specialized in Chinese mythology and legends. He launched the online youth forum on folk culture with other young folklorists, and I worked as the website administrator for several years. During that time, I assisted with some online meetings and also attended many important folklore meetings. I got to know many great folklorists in China, including Chao Gejing, Damo Chibumo, Yang Lihui, and An Deming, who inspired me to study folklore further in the U.S. I earned my master's degree in folklore at the University of Oregon in 2009, and then earned my PhD in East Asian Languages and Literatures with a concentration on Chinese folklore studies at the Ohio State University in 2015. My advisor was Professor Mark Bender, who is a brilliant scholar, also a great friend of mine. So at OSU, I took courses with many top folklorists, including Margaret Mills, Amy Schulman, Dorothy Noyes, and Mario Kaplan. The Center for Folklore Studies at OSU is like an intellectual home for me, and it connected me with many great folklorists all over the world, including you, Tim. Actually, three contributors of this book and two translators are all affiliated with this center. I'm very grateful to all my professors and friends at the center for their tremendous help and support, always, always. So this is my folklore origin story.
Thank you. Flattery will get you everywhere. And 2015 was a good vintage in Ohio State folklore studies, if I do say so myself.
Yes.
Being when I also got my PhD. All right. That's fantastic. Thank you. And Li Jun, what's your folklore origin story?
I think some part of my story or experience is similar to Zin's. I mean, you will see the pattern. So I grew up in a rural area in China, and then I went to study folklore in Beijing, and then I came to the United States and got my PhD degree. So when I was little, I read a lot of like local stories, like such as legends related to the daffodil, which is a famous flower in my hometown in Fujian. So I read a lot of that kind of story and stories about Wu Yishan. So like how Wu Yishan connects to like sort of fairies or goddess. But when I went to Beijing for my bachelor studies, I actually majored in English. So I was studying English and English literature. At the time, I didn't know anything about folklore. I studied at Beijing Normal University, which is one of the major centers for folklore studies in China. And for my last year of my undergraduate education, I went to sit in a selective class of folklore taught by the folklorist Dong Xiaoping. And then at that time, I was fascinated by the class. And I also realized that folklore was what I really want to study and what I was really interested in. So I started apply, or in the Chinese context, you need to take the entrance exam for the graduate study. So I bought books about folklore studies, and also we need to take exams on sociology. So I also bought books and to study the sociology, and then I got admitted in a master program at Beijing Normal University. So during my study at Beijing Normal University, Chinese Folklore Society and American Folklore Society were working on developing closer collaborative relationship through all kinds of activities. There were exchange activities, and there were scholars visiting universities in China and giving lectures. And also, the leadership in the folklore societies were working on long-term strategic planning on cross national, binational communication and collaboration. So I got in contact with American folklorists through my participation in these activities, either as a graduate student or as an English interpreter. And in this process, I got to know more about American folklore studies, which led to my application to the PhD program at Indiana University. So that's how I started folklore studies and then how I came to the United States and continue my folklore education and now continue my career here in the United States as a folklorist.
That's fantastic. I love our origin stories just because there's always a little bit of accident and always a little bit of on purpose in these origin stories.
Right.
So continuing with that theme of sort of accident and on purpose, I guess, can you tell us a little bit about the story of this book? I understand that, I mean, this is sort of worth knowing. What is the background? How did this story, how did Chinese Folklore Studies Today, this volume, come to be?
I think the story behind the book, it's also connected to what I said about between the American Folklore Society and Chinese Folklore Society and the development of their collaborative relationship. So as stated in our volume, this book was initiated by conversations between Chinese and American folklorists at the 2015 American Folklore Society annual meeting held in Long Beach, California. So at the conference, Ziying and I attended a forum called China and U.S. Folklore Collaborations, a Progress Report. The forum was chaired by then Executive Director of American Folklore Society, Tim Lloyd. So that forum was organized, I think, at the end of the first phase of the American, the second phase of the American Folklore Society and Chinese Folklore Society collaboration, which officially, I think, started from 2008. So since 2008, there had been a lot of exchange and communication activities and events organized by the two societies. And then at this forum, with the speakers, including then president of the Chinese Folklore Society, Cao Gejing, and then president of American Folklore Society, Michael N. Williams. The speakers not only talk about the significant progress and achievements of the American Folklore Society and Chinese Folklore Society collaborative projects and activities, they also reflected on further work needed to be done, there was reflexive discussions on what else we need to do or what other things that we can do to further bridge the American and Chinese folklore academia. So one thing that both the speakers and the audience at the forum, including Ziying and me, agreed on is that there was a need to introduce scholarship on Chinese folklore studies for American folklorists or for English-speaking audience in general. So with the inspirations from the forum, Ziying and I went to talk with the director of Indiana University Press, Gary Dunham, about our initial ideas of the volume. And he was very enthusiastic and supportive about the idea. And he asked us to submit a proposal about the conference. So when we came back from the conference, we started to talk with some scholars who study Chinese folklore. And then we assembled a small group of junior scholars whose research covers a range of important topics. We think would illustrate the diversity and dynamics of contemporary Chinese folklore studies. So I think that's the story behind the book.
I think it's great. I think it's absolutely right that, you know, many Western or many Chinese scholars are much more familiar with Western folklore theory and with some of the research that has been done than the other way around, than Western scholars are with folklore theories that have, or folklore research that is being done in China. So,
right.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely spot on. And this volume makes a great contribution to that. And that, I guess, kind of takes us into the volume itself. And so it begins with this introduction, talking about the history and trends of Chinese folklore studies. Li Jun, can you give a brief overview of some of the major historical trends of Chinese folklore studies over the last sort of 100 years that the discipline has existed?
Mm-hmm. China has a long history of collecting what we now would categorize as oral tradition, including myth, folktales, and ballads, as well as other aspects of folk culture. So there's a long history of collecting and documenting folk culture in various forms. But before the 20th century, most of these materials were scattered in literary, historical, geographical, agricultural, and other works. So in the first chapter of our book, we provide a brief history of Chinese folklore scholarship from the early 20th century to the present, to help the audience have a better understanding of the trajectory of folklore studies in China and the particular political, social, and cultural context within which the discipline has been shaped and developed. So, because during this one century journey for Chinese folklore studies, it has been intertwined with political ideologies and social transformations. The growing interest in folklore in China in the early 20th century was closely related to the idea of romantic nationalism in the context of political chaos within the nation, and also the pressure exerted by foreign powers. So at that time, there was the what we call the May 4th movement, which was an anti-traditionalism and anti-elitism movement. And it was also an anti-imperialist movement generated by the upsurge of Chinese nationalism and populism. So at that time, there was the idea of going to the people. So, I mean, before that, China had the long history of promoting or the traditionalism or elitism culture, like the classics. During this time, people were started to paying more attention to what they call the masses, the common people, and then see the value of the culture of the common people as a new cultural and political power. And then among these movements, one of them was the what we call the folk literature movement. It started with the activity of collecting ballad and folk song, also publishing this collected folk materials. And then, but so this was kind of the first stage of folklore studies in China in the last century. And then the second great impact on the folklore studies was the Sino-Japanese War, the Second Sino-Japanese War and the Civil War from the 1930s to 1940s. These wars forced most of the academic institutes to move to the border regions in southwest and northwest China. So the culture and society of these border regions were barely touched by Chinese social sciences before this period. This situation provides scholars the opportunity to start their study of the folk culture in these border regions, which were more closely associated with the ethnic minority groups. And then the scholars collected a lot of data relating to ethnic language, ethnic folk oral tradition, also ethnic practice of folk religion, and also the social organizations. So this was before the founding of the People's Republic of China. In the 1950s, after the People's Republic of China was founded, one of the major cultural and also political activities that have long-lasting impact on folklore studies in China was what we call the nationwide nationality identification, in Chinese, 民族识别. This was influenced by the Russian standards to differentiate ethnic groups. And the traits applied in the identification were common language and customs, religion, historical roots and continuity, territory, stable cultural continuity, and self-identification. So after this nationality identification, the people in China were grouped or identified into what we now called the major Han and the identified 55 minority nationalities. And even though now more and more scholars are beginning to reflect and redefine the notion of nationality, in Chinese we call 民族, but the notion of multinationality within a unified nation has set the framework for many folklorists to celebrate and study the diversity and richness of Chinese culture. So then after that, we know that there were cultural revolution, which kind of abolished the folklore as an academic discipline. And then only after the end of the cultural revolution in the late 1970s, that the folklore studies in China regained its status as an academic discipline. The Chinese Folklore Society was established in 1983. And then after that, I think there was Chinese folklore studies experienced fast development, especially entering the 21st century. The heritage studies have attracted folklorists' attention in an unprecedented large scale, which also contributes to the expansion of Chinese folklore studies in the last 2 to 3 decades.
That's brilliant. That's a lot of history to cover in a short period of time. But I think it lays important groundwork, and I think it sort of sets us up for some of the things that will come in the ensuing chapters. And so the introduction is mostly this historical look at Chinese folklore studies and its trends. Seeing then we move over to chapter one, and this is a contribution by Yong Yi Yue about everyday life and childbirth. And talking and using that as a way to discuss urban folklore studies. Can you talk about the importance of this contribution and how it helps us to understand modern Chinese folklore studies?
Thank you for the great question. Yong Yi Yue was a professor of folklore at Institute of Folk Literature at Beijing Normal University, and now he's the professor in the School of Sociology and Population Studies at Renmin University of China. So he has published numerous articles and 11 books. He specialized in popular religion, temple files, and urban folklore. Yong Yi Yue is actually reviewed as the best folklorist among the post-17 generation. The post-17 is a colloquial term to describe Chinese people born in the 1970s. In his chapter, Yong Yi Yue presents a profound discussion on the topic of urban folklore in his ethnographic study of childbirth customer in the cosmopolitan city of Beijing. As shown by his research, the rural and the urban are intertwined and interacting cultural space rather than separated spaces, isolated and contrasted to each other. So as he shows, that is the influence between rural and urban cultural elements is regarded as a more complex interactive process rather than one direction assimilation. In particular, Yong Yi Yue proposes the concept of urban folklore as a quote, a way of knowing and an epistemological paradigm, quote ends. He challenges the conventional disciplinary conception that regards urban folklore as studies of people and practice in urban cities. Rather, he claims that urban folklore should shift its study subject toward the tendency of rural-urban integration and examine it as a dynamic social and cultural process in the frame of modernity, especially when China is facing the fact that most cities have become cities of migration due to the large number of migrant workers. I think overall, Yue Yongyi, I want to highlight his conclusion. So Yue wrote in his conclusion in page 56, quote, as an epistemological paradigm, urban folklore studies, that is, the new Chinese folklore studies concerned with modernity, not folklore studies focusing on urban subjects, should intend to observe, describe, and analyze the complexity, diversity, uncertainty, or probability of this dynamic process, quote ends. Overall, U.S. research clearly shows how contemporary folklorists take a more comprehensive and factual approach to study the transmission, transformation, and reproduction of folklore in people's daily life in contemporary China.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's really fascinating. And I think the idea of taking this as a new sort of way of knowing or an epistemological approach, and particularly one that's about modernity and not just sort of focused on urban subjects, is a really interesting sort of invitation to study folklore and folk cultures in China more broadly. That's really excellent.
Thank
following
you.
Following this, we have a chapter that points to important trends of gender in China. And I was wondering if you could sort of introduce us to the chapter and sort of what its main case study is, but also how does the move, and it seems to be that there's sort of a move from women to female folklore practitioners. And what does that tell us about women's folklore studies in China?
Thank you for this great question. This chapter is written by Junxia Wang, who is an associate professor of folklore at East China Normal University. Her research focus is on the history of women's folklore studies in China and the individual life history of craftswomen. So in this chapter, Junxia gave a wonderful survey about women's folklore studies in China from 1910s up to now. She traces the history and the development of women's folklore studies in the last century and perceives the 1980s and 1990s as a turning point where the focus of studies on women's folklore in China shifted from treating women as an abstract group and calling for the liberation of women from oppression in specific historical periods to treating women as individual, quote, female folklore practitioners, quote, ends, and paying attention to their everyday life practices in a specific social network. So her case study is about a woman called Shuang Lin, from Shanxi province in the eastern part of China. So applying the model of an analytical tool of strong relationship and weak relationship, Junxia studies the Liangjia kinship relationship practice. The Liangjia refers to a married woman's parents' home or family, and also gift giving of Shuangling. She examines the formation and the practice of common people's gender conceptions in their everyday life and also in their life fields. Based on her case study, Junxia argues that although gender equality as a so-called basic state policy is today legitimized in China at the institutional and ideological levels, it didn't mean that gender equality has been achieved in individuals' daily practice in communities. So the patriarchy as a kind of long-lasting traditional thought and family structure continues to deeply influence community members' conception of gender roles in their relations and interactions with each other. Thus, the realization of women's liberation and equality status at the practical level still has a long way to go. So that is Junxia's contribution.
Wow, that's really interesting. I wonder just really quickly, seeing if you could sort of think from your own perspective, do you think that this contribution can help us in in application to Western folklore studies as well, or do you think it's pretty localized to China?
It's a good question. I think it definitely could contribute to broader scholarship about feminism and gender studies in the West. I think especially in not only in folklore studies and also in China studies broadly, we often focus the role of the state and also the market in shaping the discourse and the practice of feminism or feminist movements in contemporary China. Sometimes we didn't pay enough attention to the role of women in their daily lives and in their daily practice. I think right now I'm actually working on a new project about the transmission of Buddhism among lay women in contemporary China. So I also started to study women and gender in China. So I think definitely I also draw lots of inspiration from Jun Xia's research. I think right now we need to pay more attention to the living oral histories of women in contemporary China and their struggles. And we need to see what we could do to help not only women in China, but also people everywhere to achieve gender equality worldwide.
Yeah. Also, I think that, yeah, there's something specific about China. I mean, that especially like the local practice relating to what we call the patriarchal tradition in China, and also how like the intimate relationship between people, how people interact with their family members, relatives, which is like largely or closely I'm not confined, but we would say contingent to local context and local tradition, and that might be the practice of family relationship and or of gift giving, which were discussed in Jun Xia's chapter, might be different between China and the United States. But I think one major contribution of Jun Xia's research, and which could also be applied in the United States, is the strength of folklore research or folkloristic perspectives in the gender studies or in what Jun Xia called the liberation of the women. So we see the political power in her research or in this kind of research, or we can see the role folklore studies can play in the larger cultural political sphere of the society.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I think in some ways this sort of the question about how we can take something, some specific information, and bring it to this sort of more larger or worldwide questions about the role of folklorists in different public spheres is also something that we can sort of take from the next chapter, which is Levy Gibbs's contribution. And I'll just take a second to say we've had him here on New Books in Folklore before to talk about his book Song King, which is a different episode that people, if they've listened this far, can also listen to. This contribution, again, similar to the book, is taking on this question of folk singing, and particularly he's looking again at Wang Xiangrong, this folk song king of northern China, northwest China. and particularly his experience with Shanbei folk singing. And I guess Chinese folklore studies has a long history of looking at folk song, as you sort of intimated in discussing the introduction, Li Jun. So what are Chinese folklore studies' primary contributions to the study of folk song? And what to you is maybe the standout contribution from this chapter?
I also heard your interview with Levy on his book, Song King, Connecting People, Places, and Past in Contemporary China. So, I mean, he also talked about this, so I will be briefly touch the the content of this chapter. So, like you said, Levy also explores the topic of folk song, which is one of the most significant genre in Chinese folklore studies. I mean, like I said, the study of Chinese folklore started with the collecting and studying of folk songs and ballads in the early 20th century. I think one major feature of Chinese folk song practice. One thing is that how he relates to the political, ideological practice in the society. That Levy talks in this chapter or in his book in general. So a lot of those what we called song king or song queen, they are not only have the status of like what we call the tradition bearer from a particular place. They are also the symbol of a place, the symbol, the icon of regional identity. And then this iconic or symbolic status or image provides them with complex or multi-layer roles and functions and identities in society. Also, it provides them the channel to what Levy called meaning-making through their performances in different contexts. So, okay. I think that's one thing that's very special or particular about Chinese folk song practice in the contemporary society. And also there's the thing about heritage, but I mean, that might be another aspect of it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that all makes sense. And I think we'll also touch on heritage more in a minute. Following Levy's chapter, Ziying, this is your own chapter, and it's looking at myth, and it stems from your folklore, your fieldwork in Shanxi province. What can you sort of briefly introduce, and we'll hopefully talk about this more when we get you on this podcast for your book, but what are the myths of Yao and Xun, and how does your chapter help us understand new trends in Chinese folklore studies?
Thank you so much for the great question. So Yao and Xun are ancient sage kings who lived about 4,200 years ago. So I did my fieldwork in Hongtong County, Shanxi Province. So it's Hongtong County is under the administration of Linfen City, and Linfen is believed to be the place where Emperor Yao established his capital. Right now, there are some archaeological discoveries to prove the possibility that Yao once established his capital there. I mainly stayed in Yangxie village in Hongtong, and Yangxie is believed to be the hometown, the second hometown of Emperor Yao, and it is believed to be the place where Yao's daughter Nü Ying was born. So Yao, based on local legends, Yao had two daughters, Erhuang and Nü Ying. So after Yao became old, he tried to seek talents and find a capable man to run the country. He didn't want to give the throne to his own sons because he thought that they were not capable enough. So he found Xun and married Erhuang and Nü Ying to Xun, and then tested Xun in many ways. So later, he gave the throne to Emperor Xun. So in my study, the local people from Hongtong actually worship Yao and Xun as ancient ancestors, especially people from Yangxie called Yao grandpa, and they called Erhuang Nü Ying aunties, gugu. So from my research, I tried to use the local people's perspectives to interpret the value and the significance of Yao and Xun, as well as Erhuang and Nü Ying. So Yao and Xun's stories were reified as myths in Chinese folklore studies. I actually problematized that reification. I think we should definitely draw on local people's vernacular perspective toward Yao and Xun and see how understand their stories, the stories and beliefs. Especially in my own research, I focus on one important cultural figure. His name is Li Xuezi. I introduced his life story and also how he started to remake Yao and Xun's story in Hongtong in contemporary time. So my research is a combination of both history and ethnography. So I basically argue that we may combine the textual analysis and the ethnographic research together and to see how people really remake myths on the ground in their daily lives. That is my chapter.
Oh, that's really fascinating. So it's using this combination of textual analysis and ethnographic research to better understand how people are using myth I'll use air quotes. We'll say inverted commas myth in daily life. That's really excellent and something that I can't wait to talk to you more about.
Thank you.
And rounding things off, we have the final chapter, Li Jun, that is yours. And it brings us in many ways to the most recently arrived form of folklore studies that is examined here, but also something you sort of ended your discussion of the introduction with, and that is heritage, cultural heritage. Now, China has been preserving, again with inverted commas, culture for decades. But heritage represents the intangible cultural heritage and cultural heritage paradigms from UNESCO represents something that is somehow different from what came before. So I guess my question is two-part for you. Firstly, how is heritage different from what was done previously in China regarding cultural preservation? And what can the case of the Tulou residences that you examine tell us about China's heritage regime?
Those are great questions. So first, how are the practice of Chinese heritage different? I think the first, the most observable difference is the scale of the practice and discourse. So now some people will characterize it, the activity and relating to heritage in China as heritage fever, or that's dramatically heritage movement. So we don't hear that kind of word in the United States, I think. So just to illustrate the scale of heritage practice in China, I'm going to provide you some numbers, like statistic numbers. So by the end of 2018, there were 40 UNESCO ICH items, 1,372 national ICH items, and more than 15,000 provincial ICH items in China. In addition to this, there were 55 UNESCO natural and cultural heritage sites. I mean, the number is still growing. In China, we also have what we call the ICH or representative ICH inheritors, which is similar to the heritage fellows in the United States. So across the country, there were more than 3,000 national representative ICH inheritors, and more than 16,000 inheritors on the provincial level. Also, there are a lot of institutes who runs training programs and education events for the heritage and practice. So there were more than 600 ICH training programs organized by over 100 higher education institutes. So this statistics illustrates the scale of heritage practice in China. Another major feature of heritage practice in China, I think, is that it is contextualized by what we call the capitalist-oriented economic practice and the socialist political system. So in terms of the institutional practice of heritage in China, there's a top-down institutional organizations or institutional system that frames the public practice of heritage in China. So on the national level, we have the National Ministry of Culture, under which there is the Division of Intangible Cultural Heritage, which governs the ICH activities. And then there's also the National Bureau of Cultural Heritage, as well as the Chinese Academy of Cultural Heritage, which focuses on the tangible heritage. And then there are also provincial and county level agencies of this ICH and tangible heritage institutions. And then these are official or governmental agents or agencies. They plays a vital role in the current heritage practice in China. And then at the same time, I think the capitalist or capitalism-oriented economic practice also have an important impact on Chinese heritage practice. We see all those adaptation of ICH or cultural heritage in the economic sector, such as the development of tourism, the development of the cultural products based on the inscribed or even non-inscribed ICH or heritage items. Referring to your second question about Tulo, I think I'm talking about the nomination of Tulo as UNESCO heritage under the context or framework of what I just talk about, which is the national top-down institutionalized system and the economically oriented incentives for the heritage nomination. So how I think a specific aspect I want to point out is that how the local government as a player in this heritage nomination and the heritage economic practice, how they as local official agency plays a role in connecting the local community with the national agency and with the international organizations such as the UNESCO. I think this is something that haven't been haven't attract a lot of attention in scholarly investigation of heritage studies, and which is actually very important because the local government are the actual agency or the actual player who implement the international and national heritage policies or regulations. Also, they are the intermediate or the medium between the local community and the higher level agencies.
That's going to be a really great chapter. I can't wait to read it again or read more of it, because I think it's making an important contribution to sort of the critical heritage studies side of the discipline. So, well, those are the five chapters of the book, and we've taken up a lot of your time already. As we depart, I'd like to ask you sort of our standard final question, which is, and maybe we'll go Li Jun first. What are you working on now?
So my current project is a book, a monograph related to my chapter in this volume. So this manuscript is tentatively titled "Living Within Heritage: Tulo as Vernacular Architecture, Global Asset, and Tourist Destination." So this book is based on my fieldwork undertaken in Southeast China in the Fujian province. So it will consider the social ramifications of major legal, economic, touristic, preservationist interventions that together transform everyday life words into formal expression of national and international cultural heritage. So the chapter in the volume, my ethnography centers on the case of Hakka communities that now made famous for their vernacular architecture style we call Tulo, which is the large multi-story rent building for communal living in Southeast China. So this book will tell the story of the heritageization and museumification of Tulo communities, focusing on the experience of people living not only with but inside domestic buildings and home communities that have become re-objectified for consumption by outsiders. My second project is a co-authored book, tentatively titled "Putting Baskets to Work in Southwest China." So this book will be based on research that I have conducted with binational team of Chinese and American colleagues in Southwest China. So this is part of the China-US folklore collaboration projects. In Southwest China, baskets are an essential part of people's everyday life. And throughout this region, rural people, they make and they sell and give and buy and use bamboo baskets in an extraordinary range of forms. So this book will introduce readers to the lived worlds of baskets today focusing on the rich encounters with people whose lives are woven together with these elaborate but practical objects of handcraft.
Sounds fantastic. You got a lot going on.
Yeah.
All right. And Ziying, what are you working on now?
So I need to do some advertisement about my own book first. So my new book, Folk Literary Contested Tradition and Heritage in Contemporary China, will be published by Indiana University Press this March. So right now, I'm working on two new projects. The first project builds on recent scholarship of heritage regime to study the emergence of an alcohol regime in contemporary China with the convergence of alcohol science, state market heritage, and tourism. My case study is on fenjiu, or fen alcohol, one of the most well-known Chinese liquors made from grain produced in Fenyang, Shanxi province. So I did my field work last summer. So now I'm trying to write one article first. My second project is about the religious practice of lay Buddhist women in contemporary China. This is a collaborative project among my students and also with some colleagues in religions in the Department of Religious Studies at the College of Worcester. So for this project, we will focus on women's role in the formation of lay Buddhist communities, their engagement in charities, and their contribution to producing new forms of social and cultural identities. Right now, I'm co-writing a paper about lay Buddhist communities and folk literary in Ziyun Temple in Shanxi with my student Bai Haohang and Professor Ma Graham in the Department of Religion Studies at the College of Worcester. I hope I could finish it very quickly.
Those sound like two fantastic projects. Well, thank you guys both so much for coming on and talking to us. It's been really interesting. And let me just say, I don't know if I would have the guts to do this in my second language. And this was a really fascinating talk and I really appreciate it. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you.